Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Well, Bruce, there's a lot we could talk about here about AEW Dynamite, a plethora of topics for the show. I'll begin with the world title match. Hangman Page and Lance Archer closed out the show. I got to say, and I talked about this on my Focus on AEW VIP podcast last night, I really wanted AEW to do a better job of making the world title match feel like a big deal, not just another main event. And they didn't. I mean, it got a passing mention like 15 minutes or 20 minutes into the show, another graphic. They didn't air promos. They didn't give a backstory. It just, you know, kind of had to stand on its own. So I give a thumbs down to AEW as far as that goes. But the match itself is going to be something that appeals to a lot of people, but not others. It was leaning hard into AEW being a hardcore, gory, bloody company. Archer bled early after being thrown through a glass pane. Hangman was just a crimson mask, as Gordon Solie would say, just covered in blood. And we had barbed wire and chairs and tables. And so for that style of match, how do you think they did? And what do you think about the statement that doing that kind of match again makes? You know, it was a Texas death match, no rules. So, you know, you had to expect AEW was going to do something along these lines.
It's interesting you bring that up, because after the first hour, I wondered if the world title match would be overshadowed by everything that happened in that first hour. And I think the match itself will be remembered, but to your point, they didn't really push it too hard. They showed a graphic twice, I think, during the show, as you said. And other than that, you know, they didn't put too much into this match, which is kind of, you've been discussing this on your Focus podcast as well, but it just seems like the title reign of Adam Page right now is being booked as almost an afterthought to everything else happening around him, specifically with everything happening with Cole and the Bucks and Omega if he returns. That's not necessarily what you want to have from your world title. Now, it also does show the depth of AEW to have that kind of thing going, but you always want to have your world title be that top spot. The match, as you said, so I think they had me until Archer licked the fork that he poked in Page's head. Not just because, you know, especially in the 80s, all the issues with hepatitis being spread because of bleeding and whatnot, but we're also in a pandemic, so it just makes it a little worse to think about it that way when you're doing that. Now, I understand that they're probably vaccine tested and everything, but they also bled a lot, and I can't guarantee that none of the blood didn't fly into the crowd, especially because Page's hair is not tied up like Archer's. So for me, there is just, I know there are people, you know, like a Tyler Sage who likes these kind of matches, and I like them to a certain point as well. It looked like more of a GCW-style match, and what I will say to this match's positives is, regarding the type of match it is, I actually like how they did it, how Page just went after Archer in the back before anything could even, before the entrance even happened, because I question whether this feud needed this match. I understand it's Archer's signature match, but coming off of all the other gimmick matches they've had recently, and Archer doing this match quite often, it just seems like a bit too much at times. But I like how they booked the story in terms of Page was mad, he came right out and did that. And I like how they rang the bell once they got to the top of the stage and not necessarily waiting for the ring, because, I mean, the match was going to go all over the place anyway. So I think they did well there. But there were some things in terms of booking in these matches, not just the main event, but in the tag match earlier in the night that we'll get to later, that kind of had me questioning what's the word I'm looking for? The intensity of these matches that they put on Dynamite every week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Hangman retained after So Dan Lambert undoes, and this I thought was clever. He undid the top turn, one of the top turnbuckles, so the top rope collapsed. And it's no DQ, so, you know, can't do anything about it. And this took away Hangman Page's buckshot lariat. He hit one early against Archer, and Archer just rolled to the floor. He wasn't able to hit a second one in a traditional way, which Ross was sure to emphasize, by the way. Like, he had a cheat sheet or something. Hangman won't be able to do a buckshot lariat, said one of the announcers. And Ross goes, well, at least not a conventional one, which was kind of weird because he ended up doing an unconventional one later off the back of the referee and launched himself at Archer, which sent Archer out of the ring, off the ring apron, through one of the two tables that were set up side by side. And then Hangman beat the 10 count. So this was basically a way for Hangman to retain his title, Archer not to get pinned, but to lose by a countout, which is usually a cop-out finish, but in a Texas death match, it apparently is a more hardcore finish. So that's a little weird, too. It's all about context. So we had, yeah. So anyway, yeah, I don't know. And I didn't, again, I acknowledge some people are going to just love this. You know, it's just, it's not my favorite style of match. I don't know. And it's not all about me. It's not all about any one person. But I didn't sense watching it that the crowd was, like, super into Hangman. Now, we didn't get the ring entrance and the music and the formal ring introductions. The match didn't start till there's only about 16 minutes left in the show. They ran slightly long over the top of the hour. But I don't know. I thought, you know, some of the crowd is into it, but some weren't. And I don't know what to say. It's hard to say a match that gory and bloody and violent and wild is a letdown, because I'm not saying it is, but I think it's polarizing. And I'm not sure either way if it's the type of match that Hangman needs to get his title reign feeling a little hotter. But, man, the lack of promos and context and hype by the announcers making it seem like a big deal, it just made it feel like Hangman's not as big of a deal as he ought to be as the reigning champion. Bruce, your quick thoughts on that, and then also your quick thoughts on what they did with Adam Cole afterwards.
So I really do think that first hour with the two debuts and Punk and Mox versus FTR, that a lot of the emotional investment from the crowd went into all that. And by the time they got to, and even AQA versus Jay Cargill, because AQA, if people hadn't seen her in NXT as Ada Ramir, she, according to my timeline, she opened a lot of people's eyes tonight and won a lot of people over. She was getting a lot of cheers and a lot of oohs and ahs tonight too. And that Shooting Stars press she landed was picture perfect. So I think what happened was, This was just a very packed Dynamite, and the crowd just they weren't able to pace themselves very well. Now, regarding Cole, I'm glad that it wasn't a traditional AEW-type end-of-the-show run-in where he attacked Paige. I'm glad that he just kind of respectfully gave him the title and confidently basically said, I'm coming for that, and I don't think you can stop me, and just walked away. And for me, I think that works much better than if he would have gave him a super kick, which was what I was expecting, because that would have been expected. And here, it's not just that it was unexpected, but it adds another layer to the story between them going back to Ring of Honor, New Japan, etc. So I really like how they ended the show, even though the match itself, I think, the last half of it was a bit much.
All right, well, as you alluded to, so much more to talk about on this show. Let's pause and formally introduce the show, and then we'll get on with other topics and phone calls and emails. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, the editor, publisher, founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show, along with the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. By the way, tomorrow's flagship edition of the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, our Blue Logo Show, will feature VIP analyst Todd Martin. So look for that Thursday night on the Blue Feed. And I welcome as co-host, debut on AEW Dynamite's post show, but a veteran of the Raw post show, Bruce Hazelwood, a PWTorch.com contributor who has shifted from covering Raw with written reports on Monday nights to covering NXT with his adult perspective reports on NXT 2.0 on USA on Tuesday nights. Bruce, welcome.
You know, Wade, I did joke earlier today that the debut everybody was waiting for tonight was my debut on the AEW Dynamite post show with you. So I'm glad that people's anticipation has now been satiated. So I'm glad to join you.
Was that a rumor on Reddit also?
Oh, yeah. You know, Reddit is where you go these days to get everything, apparently. I mean, Brandon Cutler even knew where to go, and the Young Bucks didn't. So that's where you go, Wade. You got to find out.
Yes. Well, good to have you, and we want to hear other voices, too, and this show is live streamed every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. We start 5 minutes or so after the shows end, and we invite you, if you're live streaming the show right now, to call us. The number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call push 1 on your keypad, that flags you on our switchboard. We also invite you, if you're attending a Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDown, to be our on-site correspondent. If you're attending an upcoming show and are able to join us within 60 or 90 minutes after the show concludes, then drop me a line at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Be sure to put the name of the city in the subject line and the date. That helps me stay organized, because sometimes you let me know 6 weeks or 8 weeks ahead of time when you're going to a show. And so when we get closer to the show, it helps me stay organized and look you up and schedule things. All right. So with all of that said, let's get the calls, and we'll be sure to hit on a lot more that happened on tonight's show, including the debut of the AW debut of Keith Lee. I think there's certainly some stuff to talk about there. Also, Switchblade Jay White, another person speculated as making his AW Dynamite debut. He appeared, and we'll talk about the context of that. Plus, as you noted, a tag match with CM Punk teaming with a mystery partner, Jon Moxley, against FTR. Winner, if Punk and won that tag match, he would get a rematch against MJF. We had a big angle with Inner Circle, and we had, as you said, a TBS title defense, and a big angle at the beginning that set up the tag match later with MJF. I think I'm probably leaving something off. It was a newsworthy show with a lot of things for us to sink our teeth into. So we'll get into that as the show progresses. First up is going to be area code 217. 217, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Larry. I'm calling from Beardstown, Illinois. We're about 45 miles west of Springfield, Illinois, which is the state capital. I wanted to call am I the only person that noticed that in some of the lead-up advertising for the show, AEW and Tony Khan were teasing a big announcement, and they never actually made the announcement. I think the announcement itself was basically White and Lee showing up.
Yeah, I think you bring up an interesting topic. It just more broadly is the hype going into the show and if it lived up to it, if it surpassed it, how people feel about it. Because I think early in Larry, correct me or back me up on this, was it Tony Schiavone who slipped in the opening match that Tony would have a big announcement later? Is that
even
during the show? Yeah. And so I don't consider Mark Henry debuting or Switchblade Jay White showing up for a brief angle. And announced.
He called him Mark Henry.
Oh God, I did.
He pulled a Jim Ross. Wade.
He compared him to Jim. Yeah,
with his weight gain is looking a little more like Mark Henry now than maybe he used to. But that's probably where he gets it from. I understand that, Tim. But
I was looking right at my match report as I said that when Ross said he looks like a young Mark Henry. I think he looks kind of like an old Mark Henry, but that's more a compliment to Mark and an insult to Keith. But yeah, the debut of Keith Lee and Jay White appearing isn't a Tony Khan announcement. It's just not. And I guess, you know, words matter. And if people were kind of hanging on waiting for an announcement, we didn't get it, did we, Bruce?
Well, maybe I misread his tweet because I just thought he said that the Forbidden Door is going to be whatever he ever says with the Forbidden Door. Someone's on debut. Maybe I just read it too fast. I don't remember him saying there would be an announcement, and I didn't catch that during the show. But that could just be me missing it.
Well, for the sake of semantics, do want, and then Larry, you can jump in. Schiavone said during the opening angle, with Sean Spears and Wardlow and MJF, he said Tony Khan will have a big announcement about a new wrestler. So he didn't announce. Tony Khan didn't announce anything about a new wrestler. It's just two new wrestlers showed up. So you could say that's semantics, but Larry, was there other hype before Dynamite that you can point to where you think, no, it wasn't, quote, an announcement about a wrestler. it was actually something other than that you got the impression was coming.
Well, I just remember from what I've saw, a lot of the their Twitter stuff was, you know, Khan's got this huge announcement. And honestly, with everything that went on tonight, I can see where that can be a relatively minor thing. Say what you will about AEW. They're doing some different things, and they're doing some things, you know, with the Wardlow build up to where you think he'll turn eventually on MJF and that faction, and then the situation with Jay White showing up and Adam Cole and the Young Bucks talking about, you know, a little bit about the history they all have with Bullet Club. And mm-hmm. I'll give them credit. That stuff's got me really intrigued. A lot of American fans, I don't think, unless, you know, casual fans, you know, that aren't.
Larry, your phone line is breaking up a little bit. We heard you talk about Bullet Club, and it's got you, and then you're kind of faded off. Just repeat that.
Oh, can you hear me now? Okay. Well, the talk of the Bullet Club, how long do you think they can go with doing anything with the Bullet Club before it becomes too long or they have to do something with it?
It's interesting because, I mean, any mention of Bullet Club is going to get some fans excited, and it's also going to make, I don't want to say alienate, but sort of make some AEW fans go, hey, AEW, you've been on the air for 2.5 years. Can we just, like, talk about stuff that's in our universe? There's so many talented wrestlers, factions, storylines, groups, and you've got these sort of, you know, they're flashing your cool card. References to things that happened in New Japan that I know I hear from people. They just want to watch AEW. They don't want to be reminded of stuff that happened 4 years ago or 6 years ago that was super cool. AJ Styles was in Bullet Club. Kenny Omega is known for so much more than the Bullet Club now because he's been on national TV in front of a million plus people for over 2 years. So I think there's some downside to throwing everything out there to kind of flash your cool card about, hey, we used to be this. Now, on the other side of it, it's real history. And I have called for decades, especially WWE, called out WWE for not acknowledging history. I mean, this goes back to when Harley Race debuted for the WWF, and he was King Harley. And I knew him as this, you know, long-running, multi-time NWA world champion, and WWF just ignored it. And it was offensive, and fans found it, like, disrespectful to the larger pro wrestling industry. So I don't want to be hypocritical in any way, and I think it's cool. You know, I say they're flashing their cool card because I think AEW and tends to kind of do that to a certain slice of the audience too often. But in this case, I mean, there is a tangled web of history, and Kenny Omega and Jay White have a history. So you're pulling from that history in a way that is appropriate for the storyline. But you have the Elite, you have the Super Click, you've got the Bullet Club. You have references to New Japan. Sometimes it just gets a little more convoluted than I think is serving the first million, a lot of that. But especially, I think it can be counterproductive to try to attract the second million who are like, whoa, wait, what's going on? And then they have to go do their research. And I know people who follow Bullet Club closely and everything about them think those fans don't exist. It's like, of course they do. There's 2.2 million people watching SmackDown every week and 1 million people watching Dynamite. There's a ton of people out there who don't know who Bullet Club are, and they don't want to be bombarded with stuff that they don't know the history of, that they have to go do homework to find out. And so it's not really self-contained within AEW. And I'm not saying they went too far tonight, but it at some point, if you then are banking on Bullet Club being this big angle with Kenny and Jay and the history with Cole and the Bucks, you got to tell the story within the AEW universe to bring everyone up to speed. There aren't a million other people waiting out there to watch AEW because now you're going to start referencing something that has been mostly based in New Japan. But there's been some, obviously, times Bullet Club have wrestled big indie shows in ROH, and it's been referenced too. But there's a lot of history. So, Bruce, honestly, what's your take on that? Is it worth AEW going down that road? Do they sort of have an obligation to do so? So you don't pull that Harley Race card where you're just I don't know about that.
Yeah.
you don't pull another Harley Race omission where you're not acknowledging history when it's just obvious you ought to. So, you know, I kind of have mixed feelings on it, and there's just a little bit of baggage there with AEW so far, I think, not staying as focused on self-contained storylines that the larger audience are trying to attract will feel like they're up to speed on.
I'm still reeling from Harley Race Card. Hold on. Okay. So here's where I meander a little bit from what you two are talking about. And I say, you don't have to go to New Japan, even though it's most recent. You can go to Ring of Honor. And a lot of fans who watch AEW also watch Ring of Honor. Plus, you have more wrestlers from Ring of Honor making their way out and potentially into AEW. So this would be a good way to just kind of remind fans of Ring of Honor's importance. And when Paige was in AEW, he was basically a young boy in the stead of BJ Whitmer and Jimmy Jacobs in the decade, while Cole was over there with the Kingdom. And so there's a story you can tell, maybe like Cole never viewed Paige as anything when he was in Ring of Honor because of their positions or whatnot. And so you don't have to necessarily go to Japan because there's less, I think, people here in the U.S. who watch that. You can still go with the New Japan angle a little bit. I'd say I thought Kenny Omega's journey in the beginning was taking too long, but it ended up working out well. So I'm going to give AEW the benefit of the doubt in terms of their long-term storytelling, their booking, and like you said, they don't hesitate to channel what happened in different promotions and different companies. And so I think because of that, while they can get too cute, as you were saying, Wade, I'm just going to wait to see how this happens, which in professional wrestling, usually with WWE, you don't want to wait and see. But here, because I think AEW's built up the pedigree of we can come through with these things, I think they can do that. And like I said, they can go full New Japan. They can go with Ring of Honor. I think the paths are there. And even if they want to do both, where this could be a great story that can be extended towards the Memorial Day pay-per-view. So for me, that's how I think about it. But I also understand where you're coming from, because you mentioned all the time, like, especially in terms of like the Brandy promo, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, where a lot of insidery stuff is coming out instead of just, you know, doing some professional wrestling things. So there is a lot of that there too. But I think with this and the fact that it's the world title picture or the world title between, I think for Paige, after Danielson, now he has that buffer and a bona fide top tier act that will do better than just what has been happening with Paige as world champion right now.
I want to throw back to Larry in just a second. I do not think you're solving the Bullet Club problem by introducing the Decade and the Kingdom and some ROH storylines that while based in the U.S., were performed in front of crowds of hundreds. I think that actually just convolutes it, it becomes even more convoluted and outside of the universe of trying to build up a consistent million-plus audience and build to 2 million when you start referencing ROH storylines that you're citing well, and I think in passing can be referenced by the announcers as sort of background, but you don't want it to be like something that you need to know or need to do homework on in order to feel like you are emotionally invested in what the wrestlers are talking about that is that's propelling their feud forward. There is a lot of wrestling history with a lot of these wrestlers. I just don't think it serves the TBS audience that AEW is chasing to be talking about that much stuff. I mean, I think that makes it worse.
Sure, I get that. Maybe don't bring up the Decade and Kingdom by name, but just mention ROH in their promos or something about kind of where they cross paths and go from there. I get that. I think that, how do I put this? I think while the hesitancy and the questioning is warranted, I think it is a bit overblown from my perspective.
Sure. Yep. So I'll go back to Larry. What do you think about our discussion there? What do you want to add?
Well, I think if they, I don't know if you can say if they do it right. Well, if they do it right, but I guess it depends on the definition of doing it right. I think there's a lot of AEW fans that you could consider hardcores that might know the history of Bullet Club and all these different factions, but there's just as many that might not know everything. And the trick is to educate them in whatever time you have on your broadcast. That's to me going to be a hard part for AEW because they've got all kinds of talent. They've got talent that you're not seeing right now on the main shows. You're seeing on the YouTube shows, and it's going to be kind of a balancing act to, okay, here's why the Jacksons and Cole and all these guys are talking about their past. This was their past. But the trick is to get time balanced out to where you have all this other talent and you want to showcase them. You want to advance their different things. It's a tall order for them, I think. But I guess I can consider myself kind of a hardcore fan. I've been a fan since the early 80s. I bought the what you call the After magazines, and I would, since the early days of internet wrestling journalism, if you want to call it, I followed that too. But they say what you will for AEW. They sometimes, I think, try to pack too much into a two-hour show, but sometimes their storytelling and the way they do the slow burn and the way they just don't go from one thing to the other week from week, I think they're doing a decent job on that.
Yeah. I think the people who are going to pop for hearing Bullet Club being mentioned are watching. You know, like, and if they're not watching, what's that?
It's Rich Fan and Sean Radican.
Well,
copy for that, basically.
Yeah, of course. The idea is, if you're Tony Khan, is step back and go, how am I going to bring in more people? You know, I mean, Switchblade Jay White showing up is great, and I think you should give background. And I think the fact that he has a history of Kenny Omega is great, and it should be referenced. I'm not against that. What I'm against is thinking, all right, mission accomplished. We mentioned Bullet Club, and there's a history that people who have watched Dynamite and Dark Elevation and Rampage don't know about. But we referenced it, and people on Twitter are going bonkers. Oh, my God, on national television on the United States, Bullet Club got mentioned. Woohoo, forbidden doors crossed. It's like, that's the beginning. It's not the time when you pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, we got a money angle here. You got to tell a self-contained story on television. It can have references to that history, but don't get satisfied with Twitter popping. Twitter is not the world, and you're not going to get to 1.3 million and 1.6 million or much less 2 million making references to Bullet Club and then stopping there and thinking mission accomplished. I guess that's my concern as far as listening to kind of an echo chamber of a small slice of the audience that were buying ROH pay-per-views and New Japan World subscribers and thinking that's how we're going to grow. You're going to grow because Jay White is super talented and he and Kenny can sell a match to someone who has never seen them before, because what they did to earn main event status in New Japan, they're now going to reproduce in a fresh way on TBS every week. Let them show what got them, turn them into main eventers in a very tough place to become a main eventer and thrive. Show us, don't tell us what the past is. Show us in a new way now. And that, I get worried, isn't as on their mind because they're in that microcosm of people who know the intricate history of Bullet Club and the Kingdom and ROH and New Japan and PWG. And it's like, you're not going to grow. You're going to actually make people feel alienated and left behind who they should be chasing, because certainly TBS and TNT want them chasing those fans and getting them as regular weekly viewers. So that's my warning shot. Larry, oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
No, just with that context, I think what you said is very not just applicable, but everything is warranted that you just said.
All right, cool. Yeah. Larry, do you want to follow up on that or add a different topic?
Well, about all I can say to that is you've made some really good, strong points. And, again, it's going to come down to what they think they can fit into their broadcast time. And if they're going to go through with a story about Bullet Club and things like that, they need to probably do a better job of explaining who it is, what it is, why it's important in current AEW terms. But maybe one other topic, I think you may be touching on it maybe a little earlier, maybe later on. How do you think they are doing as far as presenting Adam Cole, or not, excuse me, Adam Cole, Paige as a strong world champion?
I don't think very well.
Me neither.
Hangman's a special talent, but it doesn't feel like the Hangman Page era. And I know AEW is an ensemble show, but your world champion should never feel like one of 12 main guys who happen to have a world title, and that's it. You know, like it should be more prominent. And again, the specific example is just they didn't do any hype for the match during the show. I mean, I and it's not that it's a matter of like getting people revved up for the match by framing it as a big deal. That some people don't care. They're just tuned in and like, I can't wait for that match. I already know what's happening. Don't tell me it's happening. I already know. And I get those people exist. That's not who Tony Khan is chasing to grow his audience. He's chasing the people who are tuning in the show, and you want them to become even more excited over the course of an hour, 45 minutes for the main event by things promoters do who don't just present matches, but they promote them. And having a world title match on your TV show and treating it like it could just as easily be a tag team match for number one contendership or a grudge match between two guys who aren't even in the top tier, that's just – I think that's a lost opportunity. And I think it actually defines down Hangman. Hangman can cut good promos. By the way, some of the best AEW promos are on Dark or YouTube. Like Fuego del Sol cut like this great promo for like a minute this week with Tony Schiavone, and he got right to it and explained where he's coming. Wheeler Yuta, who's not Mr. Charisma on the mic, cut a really good, and it was just to the point, 1 minute promo. Jade Cargill and Marks, I talked about this on Focus on AEW, so it's fresh in my mind, my VIP podcast yesterday. You know, Jade Cargill and Mark Sterling did a nice promo. And you can accomplish so much when you let the wrestlers talk about what's coming up next. And they don't do it within the show often enough. They need to have more references than just a graphic as we're in a rush to get to the break or a passing comment by an announcer. So it's a larger problem, but it affects Hangman Page the most because he is, I think, by far right now, in AEW's history, the AEW world champion who is – made the smallest impact and has the smallest presence week to week as the leader of the company. Now, mixing it up, having MJF talk about wanting a match with him and having Adam Cole come out, you know, there's steps in the right direction. It's not, you know, panic time, but it is course correct time. I think they need to do more with Paige, even if it's just a short backstage promo in hour one where he talks about what's at stake tonight. And doing it in that traditional way where Schiavone or Marvez is holding a microphone and let him just do his thing. I think he thrives in that environment. Bruce?
So I have two things. I'll try to be quick. The first one, it might have been in your focus from yesterday or sometime towards the end of last week. Correct me if I misinterpreted, but I believe you said that people are telling you that Paige doesn't even feel like he should be or has the confidence that he should be champion. And so that might be playing a bit into what's going on in terms of how he's coming off.
Yeah.
But then secondly, it's if you just compare him to the previous three champions, Omega, Moxley, and Jericho were focal points of each Dynamite every week. Paige is only really there if he's having a match, and he doesn't really get on the mic anymore, as you said. So for me, it's not even just the fact that they're not hyping his matches, but he's not being on the show as much as the other three champions were to reiterate the fact that he is the top person on the show. He is the world champion. Rather, we're just getting him when he has a match. And, you know, you discussed that him having a baby also did affect him a little bit in terms of not negatively, of course, but maybe priorities and how he in terms of investment he puts in different places. But I don't think he's being helped by AEW in the terms of not having him on TV every week, even just to cut, even just a quick vignette, a quick 30-second promo, something in the back, just to let everyone remember that he is there and he's the world champion.
I want him fired up with a chip on his shoulder and a mission. Mm-hmm. And I just don't get that sense. He comes across as insecure. He did after Full Gear and the media Q&A that I was part of in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. His whole storyline for a couple of years was based upon him not being sure of himself. He said he's not sure of himself. I asked him after Full Gear, you know, are you going to show up at the next Dynamite? No, you know, with a different attitude in terms of kind of being a locker room leader and setting the tone behind the scenes, not just off air, which traditionally and historically, going back to the territory days, was how world champions acted. Now it's a different era now, and I get that, but he said oh, I hadn't really thought of it. You know, it's like how do you like not think of that? So he didn't like train formally to be a wrestler. He has been a young boy and an underling who just sort of caught fire with fans with the beer drinking cowboy shit gimmick. But I do think he is absolutely, and this is me just connecting dots and conjecture, but I think he just doesn't know that he's in the class of some of the other wrestlers and doesn't have the experience and doesn't want to step on toes. And screw that. You're the world champion. Show up and act like you own the place and have that spring in your step. You can be humble with your kid and your family and colleagues after work. But when you're on camera, you know, people always talk about Eddie Guerrero. Like when the camera was off and he was backstage, he looked like he was jet lagged and exhausted and wanted to be anywhere else. And boom, the music hit, he walked out and he owned the crowd. So whatever's going on with you or whatever your attitude is off camera, leave it behind. When that red light's on, you turn into a superhero. You turn into a world champion with a mission, a chip on your shoulder who isn't – like look at Edge's ring entrance. When he comes out, it's like, feed me more of your energy, fans, and I will soak it up and I will use it against my opponent. I am so happy to have the second chapter to my career. Bring it on. I am ready to go. And that's not how he acted like when he first came back. And then he kind of realized he was kind of flat. He looked like a bike salesman in Portland, Oregon, or, you know, who's like, hey, you want an e-bike? I've got this for you. And it was like, it just wasn't a wrestler. He was just a guy. And then he turned it up. And Hangman needs that transformation too.
Well, take it from me. As an anxious millennial myself, while it's nice to see that, for me, as the voice of all anxious millennials right now, I think the better story is seeing someone who is like us overcoming those anxieties and fears to realize their own potential. And I taught college classes for a number of years. And for me, one of the things that, because this generation and Gen Z going on, that I've noticed is there is a lot of anxiety and a lot of students who don't understand or who how do I put this? It's almost as if they don't want to see the potential they have in themselves, because then that can lead to more failure, if that makes any sense.
Sure, absolutely.
And so for me, one of the things that I tried to do as an educator was to not only show them that they had the potential, but that it's okay to know you have potential to reach for and sometimes not make that potential. It's fine. So for me, I think the better story is to have this anxious millennial who is around my age overcoming those fears to become someone who understands and fully realizes his potential. That's where they need to go. And I feel like if they don't make that shift soon, then they need to hit the title off of him and then build him back up into that spotlight. That's just coming from me.
Yes, I don't want anxious millennial. I want to, if Hangman wants to get on the microphone and say, I doubted I could do this. I doubted I was good enough. I look at some of the background of some of these other wrestlers and what they've accomplished in the ring, and I didn't know that I could accomplish this. And even when I won the world title, I was still doubting it. Well, I just had two classic matches against Bryan Danielson, and I won. And I am confident right now, more confident than I've ever been, that I belong here. The fans told me that before I realized it. Hell, Dark Order told me that before I realized it. And so you can work that in, but then – that's it. Leave it behind. You're the freaking world champion. You beat Bryan Danielson. You just beat Lance Archer. You are on. I want him to talk about how he's on course to have a historically successful historic world title reign that people will be talking about forever. And that's what he wants to do. If he doesn't accomplish it, people aren't going to remember he said that, or you know, hold it against him anyway. It's just like, get us excited. Make us think you're excited about being champion. And they're not giving him a chance to do it. I don't want, if he has doubt, leave that behind the curtain. And you're the world champion and you're having these great matches. If you don't believe in yourself, leave it behind. We don't need that baggage when we're trying to watch Escapist Entertainment with the world champion who's kicking ass. Let people chant cowboy shit, do the buckshot lariat, take on a variety of opponents and get fired up and act like there's nothing more exciting in the world to you than defending a title and that no one's more confident than you. That's what people want with Hangman. They don't want a hangover from all the stuff that dragged on and on and on with Dark Order and whether he believed in himself. Just maybe one more reference to that or an occasional quick reference, but get fired up and get people excited to get behind you.
Agreed.
All right, Larry, any closing comments or topic for you?
No. I think you guys have pretty much talked about some of the things I wanted to talk about, and you've all made some great points. I know you've got plenty of show to go, and it's going to be I've been listening to you guys for quite a long time, and your callers always bring the good stuff too. And I want to get out of the way and let you get some of these more of these callers in to get with you and talk about some more of this pro wrestling that we all still love. guys, thanks for taking my call. And if you'll have me again, I'll keep calling back.
We'd love that, Larry. It's good to hear from a new voice, especially one who's been listening for so long.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you.
Beardstown, Illinois, not too far from Springfield. I love I love when people are from they're not from Chicago or Dallas, and they kind of tell us a little bit about their town. I'm the opposite of WWE. We like to hear from small towns. We don't run from it.
Yeah, I love to hear where people are from too.
Absolutely. Okay. And I want to let people know too. I know from a caller standpoint, sometimes you're like, well, I can call, but I don't know if I'm going to get on the air, and I can't stay up for an hour and a half and all that. We're not going to take you first every week, first or second every week. But if, in order to participate in the show, you need to get in, make your comment, and get out, let me know. You can email me, wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Just list your phone number and say, I'm calling, but this week I need to be on soon if I'm going to be able to get on. And because I know not everybody can sit and listen live for an hour and a half to our shows, give or take, sometimes 2 hours before we get to your call. So if that's what it takes to get some fresh voices on the air, don't be shy. We won't draw a ton of attention to it either. We'll just happen to take you first if that's what it takes, because we have some regulars who I know are just going to listen to the whole show anyway. Okay, so with that said, our number is 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad. All right, we'll go next to area code 978. 978, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, my name is Cyrus. I'm calling from Costa Mesa, California.
Say that city again, sorry.
Oh, Costa Mesa, California.
Oh, gotcha, yep. Good to hear from you. What's on your mind tonight about Dynamite?
So, overall, I thought it was a good show, and very fun to watch. I thought it was – I think Dynamite is at its best when they do just pack a ton in there, and it's very dynamic. And last week it didn't feel like that, and this week it felt like back to that formula, which I think works really well for them because they have the roster to do it and enough going on, really. So felt a little bit front-loaded. So by the time we got to the main event, I was a little tired, even just watching at home. But we did get a lot of really cool stuff. We got Keith Lee, we got Jay White, but I think the messaging around this surprise got so confusing since Friday that it almost took away from the impact. And I was on Reddit, the live thread for the show during the main event, and a lot of people were asking, well, where's the announcement? Is the announcement coming after the main event? And so I was trying to retrace the steps and see kind of where this all went wrong. And I think it starts with Tony Khan saying on Rampage there will be something newsworthy. Then on Rampage, there's a graphic that says Tony Khan has a huge announcement on Dynamite.
Yeah.
Then there are tweets after Rampage about Forbidden Door and about Free Agent and about how they're going to be one and the same. And so then it's like, okay, so I think we kind of got that with, Jay White feels Forbidden Door. Keith Lee feels Free Agent. But I think when you say Tony Khan has an announcement, most people expect him to be walking out and announcing something. That's just what I think most people would interpret that to mean.
No, Cyrus, let me actually read, because you're right. Talk about, is Tony Khan changing what Forbidden Door means? Because Keith Lee is not walking through a Forbidden Door. If it was Johnny Gargano debuting tonight, he's not walking through a Forbidden Door. It's just a free agent signing. Why are you calling it this other thing? But if it's
a door.
Yes. Literally, figuratively, whatever. If the idea is, well, it's forbidden because New Japan doesn't have a relationship with us, and there's just kind of a history there. Well, that's fine, but he's saying it like the audience, that the vast majority of the audience know what it means. And it just, again, I'm just against AEW building around clubhouse language, that where it feels like you have to know the secret handshake and you got to have a club card to understand what's being talked about. And Forbidden Door just feels a little too clubhousey, a little too cute, and it's overdone. And then people are going, well, if it's Keith Lee, which was the number one thing speculated about, if it's Keith Lee, is that really a Forbidden Door? And so now people, I think, are left wondering, well, did he just bring Jay White in just so there would be an actual Forbidden Door that was, you know, whatever, walked through? or was it supposed to be Keith Lee? Because initially, as you said, Cyrus, well, they said on Rampage, big announcement, Forbidden Door. So then there was a tweet. The big announcement for Wednesday's Dynamite that we referenced on Rampage, a free agent debut, and the person walking through the Forbidden Door are one and the same. So that would be Jay White, I guess. They're walking in the door, signing a contract, and then slamming the door shut Wednesday on Dynamite. Well, no one signed a contract. Uh-huh. Jay White's visit Jay White's appearance was referenced as visiting, not signing a contract, not Jay White is All Elite. In the context of Dynamite, he made a brief appearance and was referenced as paying a visit that nobody knew about. Then there was another tweet. With a great showing at tonight's Rampage TNT title bout, Isaiah Cassidy has earned a qualifying match for a spot in the face of the Revolution ladder match with a TNT title shot at stake. His opponent will debut Wednesday and sign a contract with AEW. Then to Sports Illustrated, Tony Khan said, it's a huge signing for us. I've created some debate about what it means to open the Forbidden Door. Yes, you have. And that's what we are going to do on this show. The fans are going to get a great night of wrestling and hope everyone is surprised and comes back for the matches it sets up. So, Cyrus, I didn't clear anything up. I just wanted to use the exact words to convey to people who weren't following on Twitter, reading the Sports Illustrated excerpts, or even paying attention to Rampage, what a convoluted mess this turned out to be. Now, ultimately, it sort of doesn't matter a lot, but I'm with you. If you say Tony's going to have an announcement, I don't want Tony Schiavone to pass it along. I want Tony to make an announcement. And a wrestler debuting is not an announcement. And they're still conflating Forbidden Door, a title shot, free agent signing, someone paying a visit. It is. It's a mess of messages. And I think it reflects poorly on their communication skills or organizational skills.
Well, we also know Tony Khan hasn't necessarily been the best at public relations in the past. And part of that is communication. And one thing here that's also for me, when you look at it this way, it's the only people who knew about Jay White was Reddit, right? And so when things like that happen, he was speculating along with Keith Lee, et cetera. For me, I want them to have one of these major announcements, signings, however they got to put them. It almost seems like they're having their own, what's it called? WWE has their own verbiage. AEW has their own verbiage now, and they don't even get them straight half the time. So, but for me, I really hope that the next time they do one of these, it's actually to bring in a women's wrestler, because I was hoping that Mia Yim was going to debut tonight too, and she didn't. So they, for me, someone like Mia Yim, especially, is someone that can add a lot of depth and quality to that women's division that has been growing, getting better. You have AQH tonight. You have other people coming in. Serena Deeb doing her thing. Hikaru Shida still there. So for me, make sure the next announcement here is someone that can add a little more depth to a division that needs it more than, say, the singles men's division.
Cyrus, back to you.
Yeah, so with that, I still thought, you know, it was a really good show, and it, you know, was very easy to watch and fun to watch. I had one more thing. Oh, yes, okay, so I do actually – so what, as we were talking about, like, the Bullet Club reference, I actually have access and communication with, like, a type of fan who I don't normally interact with, like, truly a casual fan who used to watch wrestling when we were going to school together a long time ago, and he sort of discovered AEW recently and only watches the TV. And I'm, like, a very – hardcore fan. Like, I've been a VIP member with U8 for like more than 10 years. So it's very interesting for me to sometimes have to fill in the gaps of what's left out on the television show to someone who's only watching the TV. And just to give you an idea, like, my friend did not know that Britt Baker and Adam Cole were a couple until they made out on TV. Like, and that's, I mean, they hinted a little bit with Adam Cole and Tony Schiavone and stuff like that, but, like, there's just a lot that people don't know.
Unless and really that's who AEW should be chasing, right? That's who AEW should be chasing, not alienating, not making them feel like this clubhouse isn't, that they're not up to speed and they won't get in the front door past whatever secret word you need to get in.
Yeah. So.
Or someone like you to help them out.
Yeah. I mean, so it just kind of, it's always kind of interesting. And even like, you know, there was a lot with the Kenny and Hangman storyline that really wasn't explained on TV. Like, I think the most comprehensive explanation of all that history was actually on this long Twitter thread that someone made that recapped their history in ROH and New Japan and stuff like that. So, there's just a lot that doesn't make it onto the national television show. And, I think they could do a little bit of a better job with that. I thought the CM
Punk, it can be expository where Hangman Page stands in the ring with Tony Schiavone or backstage, and he just, you know, hits a few, excuse, no pun intended, bullet points about his history with Kenny Omega and goes, I know what Kenny's thinking. He's thinking blah, 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 blah from 2017. He's thinking about what happened in 2020 when this happened. Well, let me tell you something. What matters is what's happening in 2021, and I'm getting a world title shot. I'm going to become champion. Like, you can slip it into a promo without it feeling like a history lesson or some sort of research project and talk about it, and then you're introducing into AEW self-contained narrative something from the outside, but it doesn't come to fruition as helpful in AEW unless it's on Dynamite. Cody Rhodes said people shouldn't need to watch our shoulder content to know what's happening. Uh-huh. Dynamite and Rampage should be a self-contained show. And frankly, Dynamite should be a self-contained show because something big happens on Rampage. It should be recapped and not because Excalibur is fitting it in between high spots on commentary. It should be a wrestler talking about it. So what you just said, that Twitter thread can be accomplished in an edited format that doesn't get overly wordy and doesn't get bogged down and stuff that doesn't matter to AEW, but it gets explained by the wrestler. And that's, I think, all anybody's looking for is just let me think if I watch Dynamite, I'll know what's happening. I can't think of another TV series where I would watch and think, I need to know something about something that happened years ago on a different network, perhaps in a different country, with some people who are named the same and other people have different names. I have to know this in order to fully appreciate what's going on. Stop that. Like, just tell a damn – it's pro wrestling. Don't make it more complicated than it has to be. You can reference history, but that can't be the end point of your storyline. It's got to be providing some layers of background to what is the primary story that you're telling in front of the fans in real time in 2022. Go ahead, Sarah. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. I was going to say, I did really enjoy everything with CM Punk and MJF and to see Wardlow getting these really big reactions now is pretty cool.
And great facial expressions. Like, that is a Wardlow specialty.
Yeah. So that to me was a highlight. Definitely a newsworthy show. And I did just like the pace of everything, especially compared to something like Raw, which is so slow and nothing feels that important. So, that's all I got.
Great.
I'll looking forward to hearing more of your thoughts on the show. Thanks, guys.
Well, sorry. Thanks for being a VIP member for so long. I really appreciate your support. Good to hear from you. Call again. Bruce, the CM Punk MJF angle was part of a first hour of Dynamite that I think set the record for the smallest amount of in-ring wrestling on a show. I'm not saying it's like AEW like waving the white flag on their initial mission statement, which was point a camera at the ring, have wrestlers come out and just dazzle people with high spots and state-of-the-art athleticism, and wrestlers will tell their story and get themselves over in the ring. But it is worth noting that this first hour was really different with the amount of talking with the Inner Circle and then the MJF Punk Wardlow spear stuff. It's remarkable how little actual in-ring wrestling there was. You had a Wardlow squash and in one other match that went about 5 minutes. So it's different. But the I thought MJF gloating and celebrating in an over-the-top way about beating Punk was great. I thought Punk's comeback was what a babyface should say. Babyfaces in WWE don't often have a chance to offset or rebut the BS that he'll spew. And Punk went out there and said, hey, you know, the wound was as tainted as suspect as your spray on tan, although Matt Jackson would top MJF later. Wow. So, I mean, it was a good segment. Although the drawback is you went from Punk going, MJF, I don't want to challenge you. I want to challenge Wardlow. And then it turned into, no, I want to win a tag match so that I can face you, MJF. I don't know if they missed some lines or they got too layered or too many things going on, but I don't think I need to go back and watch it and pick up on something I missed. I feel like there just wasn't a transition from Punk going, MJF, I don't want you, I want Wardlow, to, oh, I want to beat FTR with partner of my choice so I can get my hands on you, MJF. I don't know why those two things had to go on within 2 minutes of each other.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to Cyrus's comments at the end of this, but to me, I got the same thing as you because it almost seemed like CM Punk was trying to outsmart MJF and then ended up outsmarting himself.
Yeah.
In how he worded things. So the thing that, and you kind of took the words out of my mouth, it felt like though the first hour felt like the first episodes of Dynamite only in reverse without the in-ring action and more so on. Because the first two Dynamites had no promos, if I remember correctly. And so this is
a
little...
Verse, they had promos, but they were always interrupted by somebody jumping somebody who was who was at the beginning of talking. Like they had this streak of like 11 out of 12 promos on Dynamite were all interrupted by an attack from behind.
Right. There we go. Yeah. So yeah. it just felt, it kind of, not. I'm going to make this comparison not in terms of the quality, but just in terms of the layout. It's a very WWE way to start a show, is to have a long talking segment, though the talking segments tonight and generally in AEW do a better job of not only holding your attention, but building the requisite things to have an angle or a match or a story play out. And as you said, what they need to do better now is to use that history as building points rather than as the end points. And for luckily with Punk and MJF and Wardlow, there isn't much history to draw on to make an end point, so that's good. But some of these other ones, they need to keep going. Like with Inner Circle segment tonight, I know Jericho is trying to come off as the face, but he just came off as a pompous asshole to me during that whole thing. So, so for Proud and Powerful, they were getting the cheers because I've been saying that they should have been separated from Inner Circle pretty much since they formed because I've been a big fan of them since they were LAX and Impact, and particularly Santana. When I look at Santana tonight, it reminds me of the Santana that had that sit-down interview with Jim Ross before his big match with Jon Moxley for the world title when he had the eye patch because they both went around stabbing each other with the car keys. That kind of fire and passion and believability in his words, the conviction, that to me is the Santana I've always thought could be a single star. Maybe not world title level, but definitely at least TNT title level. And while they're really great as a tag team, I think Santana, there's more money in Santana as a single star than as LAX or Proud and Powerful as a tag team. However, I'm just glad they're going to break apart. The other thing I want to say about these opening promos, or not the opening, but this kind of hour of promos, is there was this episode of South Park back in the day called It Hits the Fan, and people were getting excited because they were going to say the word shit on TV. And so people were going around, and they had a little counter on the bottom where everyone started saying, you know, counting up all the curse words. And I tweeted a picture of that counter at 100 and whatever and saying, AEW shit counter tonight. Because everybody that talked in that first hour, it basically said shit at least once. And, you want to push it, but now it's getting to the point where it's just comical at how often it's being said. So I would pull back there a little bit on the promos, but in terms of the material, the conviction, the delivery, the promos tonight were done well. The last thing. Sorry.
Everyone, Hulk Hogan would always say, I'm going to kick your butt, and people would just laugh at him. Now it's like the opposite,
So last thing, going back to Cyrus's point, I think he said he had a master's in communication. You know, I have a degree in broadcasting. What we were taught is to, in as simple and as few words as possible, tell the audience what they need to know. And that is a strategy that both AEW and WWE could use to better effect than they have been doing. As good as those long pre-match videos are on pay-per-views, it doesn't have to always be 3 to 4 minutes. You could cut that down a little bit. Or in the promos, just get straight to the point, as you were saying with the promos on Dark and on Elevation. That's also, the crowd being out of it could be due to the fact that they had to sit through the Dark tapings. So this is the thing to point out.
Yeah, yep. Okay, very good. Well, keep rolling through calls here. You're still invited to give us a call. If you're listening to us live here, 347-215-8558. And push 1 on your keypad. You can also email us if that works better for you, wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, we'll go to Hinton in London, Ontario, and then after that, Bryant in Boston on deck. Hinton, welcome. Thanks for calling. Thanks for holding. What stood out on Dynamite tonight for you?
Hey, Wade. Hey, Bruce. Good to talk to you, I think, for the first time. How are you guys doing today?
Doing well.
Awesome. I wanted to first ask regarding Jim Ross. I thought he had a good night tonight, although he wasn't really energetic. The things he said, I thought, really added to people's superstar aura today, and this felt like a show that was a bit more right up his alley, especially in that tag team match that we saw that was very traditional and not very AEW-like. And there was a couple of squashes. You had the Wardlow squash and then the Keith Lee squash, right? So did you get the same vibe from JR that I did today?
Bruce, what do you think?
I think it's notable that the worst thing that came out of JR's mouth tonight was immediately comparing a big black guy to another big black guy in Mark Henry, which is almost as predictable as Chris Jericho comparing the two Latino people in his, or two of the three Latino people in his faction to probably the only Latino friend he had in Eddie Guerrero. It's just, you know, it's all predictable. However, I think that the fact that Jim Ross was kind of, how do I put this? While he was there, nothing he said was overly notable. That's probably a good sign. I think that Shivani did a better job today, particularly in the main event, because he was the one who pointed out the fact that Paige can't hit the Buckshot Lariat without the top rope. And I know some people have questioned, what does Shivani actually add to the broadcast booth except someone who's excitable? But I think tonight was one of those nights where he showed what he does add. Excalibur, I think, was also good because he wasn't as over the top as usual. I think tonight was a good night for the announce team, just in terms of the fact that we're not necessarily talking about major faux pas as we normally do on these shows when it comes to their announce team.
So I thought Ross had really nice enthusiasm at the top of the show. I think saying he can't hit the Buckshot, well, at least not conventionally, was a little Bobby Heenan-esque when Hogan walked out. Which side is he on? When every other wrestling announcer for every other entrance by Hogan in history had been, of course he's on the side of righteousness, and no one would ever imagine him turning heel. And I, you know, I've heard defenses for it, but it didn't need to be said because it made people think, oh, wait, this is when Hogan turns heel, because Bobby's clued in on it. A very, very, very different degrees of importance, let me make that clear. But nevertheless, I think the story was the top rope's down, the heels have taken away, the number one move for the world champion, will this cost him a world title? Ross did not need to throw immediately out there, well, maybe there's an unconventional way that he can still do it, which then made the spot with the referee feel as contrived as the fact that Punk got shoved right into Cash when he happened to be standing right in that spot with the ring bell in his hand at that exact moment. You want to avoid contrivances. You want to avoid things seeming a little too convenient. So I could have done without that. But, I mean, yeah, I thought it didn't jump out to me as especially good or especially bad, but I enjoyed Ross's commentary tonight. And there are times where he seems, you know, not as in sync with the product. I mean, yes, Ross loves Wardlow, you know, and when Keith Lee came out, you know, he's like, hey, he's an athlete too, and now he's having some Mid-South flashbacks. So, you know, yeah, there were things on this show that were more up Ross's alley. I thought the tag match got a bit convoluted in the end.
Yes.
And would have benefited from just some simplification. There were a lot of good ideas in there, and I think 60% of them would have been better than 100% of them, and then stretch things out a little bit more. That'd be my one critique of that. But it was cool seeing Moxley and Punk in an unadvertised tag match against FTR, teaming together and doing their thing.
Yeah, while the tag match, the thing that took away from the episode for me tonight were the contrivances, as you said. Like, how is Cash going to know that Mox is going, or that Punk is going to get a roll up on his buddy, and then his buddy's going to kick him into the ropes, right? Just right there for the bell to be hit. Why didn't Punk go help Moxley into the ring when Mox is almost being countered out? These are some of the things that, to me, like, they're so logical that they're overlooked sometimes. And those are the things that when you're already trying to have some cognitive dissonance with professional wrestling that you just can't really have. And that I know the tag match was fun, but those were the things that made me lose some believability in what was happening, because if I was there and my partner's getting counted out, the thing I would do is go rush over, pick him up, and try and roll him in the ring real quick. Like, I wouldn't just stand there and implore him to make it to the ring. So those are just things that can be shored up. But it's nice that we can talk about little minute details like this rather than whole macro details that generally happens with WWE, especially on Raw.
Hitting back to you.
Yeah, and I also didn't like that CM Punk kicked out of a ring bell when last week he couldn't kick out of a ring shot. It's like, okay, I guess he's, done some skull exercises or something.
MJF did that strong.
I guess. And also a good point about the connection between Keith Lee and Mark Henry. Like, they don't have much in common at all, really, now that I think.
Yeah.
So. I want to move on to something minor that happened, but I think it was more prominent on Rampage. The Britt Baker reveal that she is the one who paid Mercedes Martinez. So to me, this story is very, very convoluted. So I don't understand why Baker was interested in making sure Rosa didn't win the TBS championship when Martinez first attacked her, right? Because wouldn't that title have kept Rosa away from the world title, right? We don't exactly have mid-card champions challenging the world champions in AEW canon yet. And when Baker was initially interviewed about her thoughts on the TBS title tournament, she was actually happy that it would keep some of the roster away from her, right? We actually criticized her on this show, like, burying the championship. So by this logic, it would have been in her interest to keep Thunder Rosa within that division. And also, why did she confront Martinez on camera when no one knew about her paying off Martinez beforehand? Like, you could have still, if you are presenting yourself as a smart heel, why are you revealing yourself now, right? It's not like AEW has told us a story of Baker suddenly starting to get paranoid and irrational. Like, the more I think about it, this story just doesn't make much sense to me. Am I alone in this, or what do you guys think?
No, I don't think you are. You pointed out even more inconsistencies than crossed my mind, but I think it makes sense what you say. Bruce, what do you think?
To me, the biggest inconsistency that hasn't been brought up yet is she already has two cronies. Why does she have to go pay someone else to go do it when she could have had her cronies do it for her? I guess if you want to go, and this goes to what Hinton was saying, maybe if it was that they're stringing along who paid her, then that could have been good. But since they revealed her as already being the person that paid Martinez, then it doesn't make any sense. She should have just gone with Hayter or Rebel to be the ones to do it, and maybe they got rebuffed, and that leads to her paying Martinez. It skipped a step or two here, and I think he's right. As much as Britt Baker has been good as a world champion, she seems to have at least one or two feuds in between a great one that has these sorts of hiccups in them that make you question sort of, how do I put this, maybe her top potential as not being where maybe we thought it was before. And this is one of those situations where, partly due to how AEW is booking it, but it's one of those where it just doesn't make enough sense. And regardless of how well she's trying to do the promos and put it over, there's just too many steps they have yet to connect that you can't really take this as necessarily believable as a top feud, if that makes sense. Because it seems like more Rosa versus Martinez than Baker versus Rosa.
Yeah. Hinton, any follow-up on that?
Yeah, just wanted to correct you. Hayter did lose to Rosa, I think, in the semifinal of the tournament. And Baker did allude to that in her promo on Rampage. I did pay attention to that. But still, like, there's other much bigger, you know, issues with this connection. And I also want to talk about Rosa here for a bit. So I think AEW right now, they're doing good with their women's division, but they have a babyface problem, right? You've got Baker, who's in a strong position. You've got Deeb, who's doing some great work. Jade Cargill, who's dominant, but like the top three that I'm seeing the most on television are heels. And Rosa, yeah. I think they could do more with her. Like, to me, what I noticed was there were three consecutive weeks on Rampage where they did the same promo with her and Martinez. They were just yelling at each other on camera, right? Instead, why not have Rosa, you know, prowl around backstage with a 2x4 and, like, sit in a parking lot waiting for Martinez to arrive with whoever, right? Like, do something more than just, you know, yelling at a camera for multiple consecutive weeks. Like, you have to build someone up and give her a variety of things to do, in my opinion, than just standard, you know, babyface challenger stuff that AEW tends to do. I think back to, like, you know, Undertaker waiting for, like Austin in one of those early, you know, 2000s episodes. And I'm like, yeah, that's what makes a cool babyface, right? That's what makes a top babyface. What do you guys think of the way they're handling Rosa right now?
I want AEW to be more in the star-making business in a more consistent, almost relentless way. And they move – I mean, remember when Ty Conti was – all the rage, and then she's like just not even around, you know, like there there's only so much time, and I get that, but Tony Khan talks about wanting to bring in more announcers. He told Sports Illustrated, I'm continually looking to improve the roster and bring in new stars and create fresh matchups, and that's what you're going to see this Wednesday. We now have such a strong roster of wrestlers under contract, we can put fresh exciting matches on Dynamite every week on TBS and Rampage every Friday. Well, it's starting to be like a Cheesecake Factory menu, where it's like a book, and it's not focused. At some point, like, I just think they've got to choose fewer wrestlers to focus on who fit certain slots. And I just don't know that there's ever someone stepping back and going, all right, who do we believe in, and who are we going to push in for at least a four-month span during this year, the first 4 months of the year, and then you got the summer 4 months, and you got the fall and winter 4 months. And we're going to plant seeds and bring people along slowly. We're going to have, you know, we're going to have wrestlers mention, announcers mention this wrestler. We're going to have a promo with them talking about their aspirations or their success or why we should like them or not like them as we ease them into a spot where then for 4 months they're just pushed. And that doesn't mean you stop it after 4 months, but you commit to it. And I would like to see something along those lines with the babyface women's division. Like, figure out who your top three babyface women are going to be and don't bombard us with too many other choices and water down how focused it is on them. Raw and SmackDown is presented very differently, and there's obviously flaws in the way that they go about the rematch after rematch after rematch, 50-50 booking and all that. But you know who the stars are in every division at every level. Even in, I mean, tag team's probably the weakest, and Intercontinental title sometimes gets forgotten about. But at the top of the card, you know. And I AEW, just understand, what is a babyface? A babyface isn't some old school passe thing. What a babyface is a wrestler who fans like, and you recognize it. And then you use the power of your production values and announcers talking about them and showing off what they can do in the ring and having other wrestlers talk about them and build up emotion so that the fans are invested in seeing them succeed on a journey. And AEW does not tell that story with their female women's division right now. Bruce.
To me, the issue that I see with their babyface women is that the people you look at as who could be those babyface women for them are still sort of finding their footing. You know, it could be like a Red Velvet, it could be an Anna Jay, etc. But there's no one who's at the level of the heels they have in the company, aside from like a Thunder Rosa or a Riho, that are, you know, the Nyla Roses, the Serena Deebs, the Britt Bakers, the Mercedes Martinez. And that's one reason why I've been advocating for Mia Yim to be signed, because I think, you know, she would definitely add a bit to that. But like you said, so let's just focus on Thunder Rosa, because that's what Hen's question was in the first place. When I saw her at NWA, her promos, aside from those vignettes they had about her when she's training for MMA, like, her promos were not that great. Then you look at what she's done and how much she's progressed over the last about 2 years in AEW, and her promos now are, sure, they're not, like, top tier, but they're much better than they used to be, and there's more believability in the words that she speaks. She is definitely someone that not only has the in-ring skills, can bring it on the mic when she needs to, but has the backing of fans as looking at her as a babyface. I think what helps is that outside of the ring, no one has ever said any bad things about Thunder Rosa, and a lot of AEW fans know that, and that helps to build that. But also, you need to have your baby faces out there week to week, even if they're just winning matches against random people. You need to have them win so that they can have more conviction in their words, and that believability transfers to the crowd, because heels don't need to win, or they can win with DQs, or they could win with these tactics that babyfaces can't. So you have to keep them strong, but you also have to make sure that they are getting over, that they're speaking out loud, I'm coming for the championship, I'm coming for you, just lay it out there. And again, to me, it's more about Rosa and Martinez than Rosa and Baker, and Baker's the one with the title. And I think that is, one of those, what did you call it earlier, a contrivance that they could have avoided if they just, didn't skip those steps we discussed earlier.
All right, now, Hinton, back to you.
Yeah, I think that's all I got to say for today. I'll let you guys make play for other callers. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Great, thanks, Hinton. Appreciate it. All right, we'll move to Bryant in Boston next. Bryant, thanks for holding. Thanks for calling. What's it on Dynamite for you tonight?
Hey, guys. I just kind of wanted to expound on what you've been talking about with the women's babyface side of the division. I have to say I was really disappointed. I thought the show overall was good, but, There were rumors like during the afternoon and into the evening that there would be an additional debut besides Keith Lee. And, I was hoping it would be the women. And when I found out it was Jay White, I was not happy about that because I don't give a shit about Jay White. No, pardon my language, but I don't give a shit about him. I saw when I used to watch Impact, I saw him. I wasn't impressed, not in the least. The problem is that Tony Khan keeps adding to the men's division, and he doesn't need to do that, and he shouldn't be doing that. I mean, you want to sign Keith Lee, that's fine. I get that signing. I probably would have made that signing myself if I was an executive, but you don't need to add Jay White or Tony Nese, or he's adding too many people on the men's side and, making it harder to book, in, like you said, make it harder to focus on fewer people as stars. And the problem is he's not, the men's division is fine. It just needs to be booked a little bit better. And, the thing that needs work is the women's division, particularly babyface side. And I'm going to go with the elephant in the room here. I mean, Mia Yim, certainly you could sign her, but there's two women who are kind of above her in terms of that. And that's the former Ember Moon, AKA Athena, and of course, the big one, Toni Storm. And I don't know what the situation with Storm's non-compete clause. I mean, she can go ahead and say F that in terms of the non-compete clause and just refuse to get paid and just go to AEW, period. I mean, Khan should be focusing on signing those two and maybe Nixon Newell as well. That would solve, and bringing me in too, that would solve your women's division depth problem and on the babyface side of it overnight. And instead of focusing on that, which would be the prudent business-wise thing to do, he's focusing on padding the men's division with stupid signings like Jay White. And I don't care. Like, focus on the women. And I just want to know what you guys' opinions is on that.
Well, Jay White is really good, but AEW needs to show you, Bryant, why you should care about Jay White and not because
I don't care about Jay White and I never will.
No. Well, okay. other people who don't know who he is, and a lot of people don't know who he is, haven't seen him before, they can't go, yay, mission accomplished. We got internet, we got Twitter going crazy because Jay White walked through the forbidden door. Like, that's, you know, whatever. 5%, 50% of your audience is going to be all excited tonight because of that. And that's great. That's not a bad thing. But it's the beginning, not the end. It's the very beginning of building up to the rest of your audience who Jay White is and why they should care about him, and let him show why he earned top-tier status in New Japan. But he has to show it on Dynamite. It doesn't just come over with him. As for the women, yeah, I mean, I'm not against AEW finding their acclaimed or their Hook or their Sammy Guevara in the women's division and picking out the best two or three women who have been on AEW Dark consistently doing good work for the last year or two, and just decide they're going to be your next big star. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
whoever
they choose. Well, yeah, I don't know why someone's walking in the door getting a TBS title shot when other people have to go through, you know, hoops to get a title shot. So I'd like there to be more consistency to that sports side of AEW for sure. And that didn't need to be a title defense. You know, they could have created a backstory. They could have waited on her, give her some wins on Dark, you know, build up, whatever. There's ways, better ways to tell the story than they did. But I don't know that. I bet there's four women who have been wrestling on Dark who are better than Ember Moon. And so I don't think you need to, and I mean that seriously. Like, I don't think she was this great loss for WWE. I don't think she's awful, but I don't think like she's the person you just bring in and build around. I think there's other women they can just decide they're good enough, and we're going to now work our magic. We're going to put them in a position to look the best they can. We're going to have the credibility of our announcers put them over. We're going to give them wins over women who can take good bumps and make them look like $1 million and tell a four-month story with them. And then if it doesn't work out, you in the meantime, you're building up somebody else in the undercurrent, and then they rise to the forefront 4 months later. And that's the kind of long-term planning and commitment and focus that I think would help them. And, you know, trying to sign everybody from WWE and just crowding your roster, women or men, isn't getting where they need to be. And Toni Storm would be great, but I don't know that even just signing her solves everything, because I think she might get in the same rut where they make a big impact, but then they kind of get lost in the crowd because there's so many people on this roster and a lack of focus that I think leaves some fans bewildered. Remember when Miro used to be in the company? You know, and for a while, remember when Lance Archer used to be in the company? Well, no, but
Miro's,
are we hearing about him?
Though.
Are they? But they're not talking about him. You know what I mean? Like, my point is there's focus, and then they're gone. Archer was injured too. But there's these stretches of time where people are the focus, and then they disappear without explanation, and then they come back. And I like, you know, when there's vignettes that build up somebody coming back, that's great. Malakai Black had a brief vignette, but we can sit here and talk about all these people who are the focus, and then they're not the focus. Cody Rhodes, remember when he was in the company? How do you go from being in as big of a segment and as big of a deal to now not even being mentioned? I'm not for everyone being overexposed every week, but viewers need to kind of know who are the top stars, and AEW needs to just do a better job focusing on them for a while. Go ahead. You're itching to jump in, right?
To be fair, Cody Rhodes kind of did it to himself because, thankfully, Brandi Rhodes is not on television tonight, because if you want to tank your ratings, having her in a prominent segment is a good way to do it. So hopefully Khan puts foot down on that. But, I'm going to push back a little bit on your AEW Dark point with the three or four women better than Ember Moon. That might be the case, but they're not better than Toni Storm, in my humble opinion. Storm's better than pretty much any woman they have on the Dark thing.
I picked out Ember Moon and not Toni Storm, on purpose.
And
it's more an example of what you don't want to do is just seem like you are the landing place for everybody who was cut for good or bad reason by WWE. And, Bobby Fish. It's been too many. And I read that quote from Tony Khan, not Toni Storm, in Sports Illustrated, you know, that he's just looking to create fresh matchups. I don't want fresh matchups. I want, with new people coming in, I want the matchups we haven't gotten yet from the people who have been around for 6, 12, 18 months or 2 years. And so, Bruce, jump on if you want to respond to that.
So I'm in the minority a bit because I understand her appeal, but I've never really been a big Toni Storm fan. I think to me her character has just never really drawn me in. Like, she's good in the ring. I give her that. I just never have really cared for her character presentation wherever I've seen her. And I personally, I'd sign Mia Yim and Athena before I would sign Toni Storm. Personally, part of that is that as a Korean American, I want to see another talented Korean American have her chance.
Yeah.
At a lot of these mediocre white men like Tony Nese and Bobby Fish are getting that. She isn't getting, for example, right? So for me, I understand the point, but it goes back to what I said earlier about how it seems like all the faces they have lined up in the women's division for AEW are on the dark path and still needing to be built. I do think, however, if they allowed Nyla Rose to use the personality, her natural personality she has on Twitter and on Twitch and those kind of things, that she has good babyface potential because of how witty she is, how quick she is with her jokes, that can both be funny, but also they could sting a little bit. And for me, I think that if they wanted to turn to someone who's already a bit established, it would take work because of how she's been presented as this monster heel, but I do think that she does have babyface potential. However, again, it just still goes back to they haven't done as good of a job. I mean, Jade Cargill also has tremendous babyface potential. I think we can all agree on that, but they're not at that point yet where those two acts can be babyfaces. And so they just need to whether it's Thunder Rosa, whether it's Riho coming back, whether they fast-track someone like an Anna Jay, they just need to make sure that they are present, they are there, and they are given an opportunity to not just compete, but also give promos and let people know why they should get behind them.
Yeah. The problem with Jade Cargill Thunder Rosa in my head. And Nyla Rose is they're just going to be bigger than all their other opponents. And I still think there's a dynamic issue there. Hulk Hogan got away with it with, you know, a lot of his opponents who were smaller, Orndorff and Hercules Hernandez. I mean, it was just like on and on. He was bigger than, but ideally you don't want, you know, the baby faces just look like they're physically a level mm-hmm. above. And that was an issue with Charlotte too, but it just gets into the issue. It's not clear in AEW, you know, who the centerpiece acts are and the personalities. People love Britt Baker for sort of meta reasons, wit reasons, Tony Schiavone. Yeah. That was cute. That was fun. But, you know, she wants to stay heel. She's committed to that, but there just isn't that commitment to who are the top three or four baby faces that are kind of in rotation with some undercurrent of some rising stars. Brian, back to you if you have anything else.
Yes. Just a side note. I'm not really big on medium compared to Toni Storm. I mean, I haven't really been sold too much on her. I mean, the most thing I know about her is she had a really good street fight match with Rosemary in Impact back in the day, but I'm not really sold on her compared to Toni Storm. But anyway, I really like the tag team match between FTR and Punk and Moxley. That was just a really good kind of old style tag team match. They didn't get too fancy or anything. Probably went on a little bit longer than it should have, but I really liked that match. You know, it was nice seeing FTR get used well, and I'm interested to see what sort of match or stipulation Punk does. And the last thing I'll end with, and then I'll let you guys get on to whatever else it is you're going to do. I so badly want to see Wardlow during one of those squash matches once, like, intercept Sean Spears when he's about to do a chair thing and just powerbomb the crap out of him multiple times. That way he takes that face where he looks like he wants to make a bad fart joke, and then he starts farting as he loses control of himself, getting powerbombed all the time. I want Wardlow to crush him like a bug. Anyway, thanks for taking my call tonight, and have a good one, guys.
All right, great. Thanks, Brian. We brought up Keith Lee a couple times in passing, and I want to get to emails here in a moment. But I wrote this in my report at pwtorch.com. I think that his match tonight was just an encapsulation of why WWE grew frustrated with him and cut him, but also why it was so difficult for them to do so, and why they gave him so many chances before they did. He's so talented. He's so charismatic. He has an undeniable connection with the fans. He's athletically gifted, but he's carrying way, way more weight than Yadu for what he's known for. And it affected his cardio tonight and his agility. It did in WWE. They talked with him about taking his being a professional athlete more seriously, treating his body better, showing up with better cardio, making sure he could keep his opponent safe, making sure that he could keep up on what was going on in the ring, and amplify what made him so special and gain so much acclaim early on the indie scene and stand out in NXT. And he didn't, and he hasn't in his off time. He showed up way overweight, out of shape. Isaiah Cassidy's creating all the movement, bumping left and right. And, I mean, Lee does not walk out there looking like he's taking being a professional athlete, trying to earn a big money. Seriously, that to my eyes, and that's what drove his friends, his advocates, his backers in WWE nuts, where they just finally threw up their hands. And now Tony Khan has apparently signed him. And I just don't know if the sense of I am who I am and take it or leave it is going to go over in the AEW locker room any more than Karrion Kross not taking bumps and being super limited got over on the main roster in WWE either. I mean, there's a reason some of these people don't make it, and I know it's not popular in some circles and the crowd's reacting because Keith Lee's going to finally get his chance, but he didn't show up like he had something to prove. He showed up like he didn't have to change for anyone. That was my first impression, and I think it showed in this match. What do you think, Bruce?
First, congratulations to him and Mia Yim. They were married over the weekend, so happy wedding or happy marriage to those two. I noticed that, to your last point, he was wearing his exact same gear from NXT as well. and even people like Adam Cole and Bryan Danielson, when they came over, they did subtle shifts to how they were gearing up themselves for matches. And that probably would have helped here. I also think that, so when I cover NXT, and the last 2 weeks have been Saraya's kind of return. And last week they had her against a literal first time person, no name on the roster. And the match went about 4 or 5 minutes. And I noted that if this is your return match and you talked about how you refound yourself, all these things, that should have been a 1 minute squash. I think too much offense was given. Here, this should have been a 1 minute squash, especially against someone the size of Isaiah. Going back to your point about, you know, Nyla Rose and who else did I bring up? Jade Cargo being too big to be faces. Like, Keith Lee against Isaiah Cassidy, you don't expect that to go longer than 30 seconds, really, right? So for me, part of the mishap here was that the match was booked to be too long. It should have just been a quick squash for Keith Lee. That would have helped kind of hide some of those cardio issues that showed up, because on one of his springboards, he almost clipped the top rope with his feet because he couldn't get enough air, maybe because of the weight that he's carrying and not being in as good of shape as he was in NXT. But again, he has undeniable charisma, an undeniable connection with people. That little smirk he has for some reason just draws people in to him. He has this aura about him that there's something intriguing about him. Yet, I'm bringing up Ring of Honor again. I think to me the best Keith Lee was when he was tag teaming with Shane Taylor as the Pretty Boy Killers. That was the first time I saw both of them, and I became instant fans because they were doing things for men their size that you would not ever expect. And you saw some of that NXT, but if you want to see Pete Keith Lee, to me, it was Ring of Honor. And how do I put this? I want him to be comfortable, but I also want him to be comfortable to where he's able to reach his potential rather than hindering himself, which, you know, you've talked about on your VIP feeds for basically the last, you know, since he was released and on, about the reputation he's had and how
I talked about it for months and months before his release. It was
exactly,
it was portended, it was an issue ongoing, and people kept saying, why is he not getting pushed, where is he? And it's like, people, I know people were rooting for him and on his side, and he just drove management nuts, and they wanted to make him a star. They rebooted him, and he just they just knew they couldn't. I mean, they decided they just couldn't invest in him anymore. And I don't know what you mean by wanting him to be comfortable. I want him to draw money for me. I want him to keep Russer safe. I want him to have cardio. You know.
Sure, sure. I meant comfortable in terms of personal comfortability, in terms of where he's at. You know, the atmosphere, the organization, et cetera. But, and you know, sometimes, I think everyone has this example in their life where we have been the problem. We've been the one that got in our ways too many times, and we're the reason why we haven't reached certain things. And from all the reporting that you've had on Keith Lee, it seems that the biggest issue for Keith Lee is Keith Lee.
Yeah. No, I mean the biggest asset is Keith Lee, but the biggest thing holding him back is Keith Lee. And
exactly,
wait till AW asks him to do a job. Wait till that happens. And you know, did they do their due diligence on what they're in for at that point? And I don't want big men doing things that big men don't do. I want Keith Lee to be in good shape, and I want him to be physically capable of doing these cool moves. But what's going to draw is, like, Keith Lee is special because of that, almost having to do nothing and just carrying himself in a certain way with that glow, with what Conan once told me is the angel, that that invisible charisma that connects you with the fans, and he has it, and he's blowing it. And, I mean, maybe he'll have a great attitude behind the scenes, and maybe he's dedicated to getting himself in shape. And great, then show everyone. But this Keith Lee on TV was the encapsulation of why WWE gave him chance after chance after chance after chance, and why his friends were so frustrated with him in that company. And, you know, that's a big debut. The announcers put him over big. Tony Khan, I don't know what he spent on him or what kind of commitment they have to him at this point, but due diligence. Due diligence. Find out why people were let go before you bring them in. And have a talk with them and have the credibility to go, okay, we want to turn you into a star, but I know what the issue was before. Tell me your side. And then we'll debut on Dynamite, but you need to, you know, do this X, Y, and Z for us to really sign you to a long-term contract. We're going to put you on Dark, give you some wins. And I want to see changes over the next 6 to 12 weeks. And we need to, you know, see if you can get to the point that then you deserve, you've earned the scarce national TV time on Dynamite with all these other people who aren't getting TV time, who have earned it and deserve it. So anyway, I mean, that's...
Well, last thing, maybe the best comparison then, because of how you described him, is to book him like you've been booking Wardlow.
But why do that for someone who's not going to get in shape and they're going to whine about doing jobs? And
but maybe that'll give him the – but I'm just trying to play devil's advocate to a sense, right?
Yeah.
If – because of what you said, he doesn't have to really do much, right? And he has that sort of charisma. He can just do facial reactions. Try to book him like Wardlow, and maybe that will give him another kick in the ass to really get in shape again. It's just something to try and – because they find him. He's there
well,
now.
They can,
so they're going to
yeah.
find that.
Well, do it on. They can have him start squashing people on Dark, but I wouldn't give precious scarce time on Dynamite to building up his star power and having him plow through people and give him Wardlow's gimmick. If all along they're just running into the same roadblocks that WWE management did, like Keith Lee has a lot to prove, and I don't give him a push on TV because of something he did in ROH that impressed, you know, a small number of fans because of what he could do for his size when he can no longer do that safely at his current size. And he has all this baggage he's bringing in. I don't want to overreact to this one match, but I'm taking the totality of what I've heard about him and how much WWE did not want to let him go and how painful it was that they just realized we've tried all the, you know, you're trying to rehab him. You're trying to play devil's advocate. But the WWE management wanted to make money with him. They loved him.
Yeah.
And he just drove them nuts. And his friends were like, I mean, the mood and the body language when he was asked to do something he didn't want to do or didn't like, it's just like there just comes a point where you're like, we've got to shift elsewhere. And I just don't know if Tony knows what he's in for, but this was a big buildup all week for a big surprise. And Isaiah Cassidy flew over the ring for him. And Keith Lee showed why he's a potential star, but also, you know, I think it was, you know, visible to everybody this is, you know, they've got so many people to push, and you've got to act like a professional athlete who's taken that aspect of your job seriously. So anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but I feel like it has to be emphasized because people are still hung up on him being this fast rising star, having good matches on the indie scene. And it's like, there's this whole other recent history you can't ignore that cost him a job in WWE when Vince McMahon and a lot of other people wanted to make him a top six star in that company. Like there was a desire to do that, and he just made it impossible. And I think rightfully so. This is not WWE's fault. Okay, let's grab an email here. JB from Detroit says, from my perspective, this was arguably the best Dynamite in AEW history. So you think this will be a positive email, right? His next line, but to rain on the parade a little bit. I have a small nitpick. During the Texas Deathmatch, JR mentions he isn't sure why Dan Lambert is at ringside, and I felt the same way. Excalibur does his best to explain it by saying that Lambert told Archer that Archer could take him out, that could take out him or Hangman for the AEW championship, but I'm not sure why that would make Lambert and Archer align. And also, why are the Ass Boys getting a title shot on Rampage this Friday again? So anyway, Bruce, your thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, there was a lot of – some of that main event was overbooked a bit. When you were talking about JR bringing up, oh, maybe he'll hit it unconventionally, I was fully expecting to see Paige hit a deadeye on Archer to end the match because he didn't have the buckshot available to him. Mm. But because of what JR said, that I knew that it was going to be some kind of unconventional buckshot. So that took me out of it. And then what was the second part you said?
He brought up well, the first point was about Dan Lambert, not the finisher.
Right, right.
So Excalibur tried to explain to JR that Lambert told Archer that Archer could take him or Hangman – take him out or Hangman for the AEW championship, but why would that make Lambert and Archer align?
Yeah.
So can you explain storyline-wise? Help?
No, I cannot, especially because he's been so wrapped up with Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page and Sting and Darby Allin, I believe. Oh, no, not Sting and Darby Allin. Who was recently? But he's been focused on them and not necessarily Page or Archer. So it's a bit – and, of course, Brandy last week. So there's – Lambert seems to be someone who wants to do everything as a team player, but then because of that is in too many things that it doesn't make sense. I've heard from you and others is that he's well-versed in history. He understands booking. He's really trying to be an asset to AEW. Maybe he just pulled back a little bit because I don't think that part made any sense. It made sense why Jake Roberts was out there, of course. I think the dissension between Roberts and Archer was interesting at the end with the DDT spot. But besides that, Lambert was the big question mark for me, especially because he was the person that ended up making the top rope go away when I think that should have been someone else that was more related to Archer or Archer himself.
All right, up next, Zach in Texas begins his email similar. This was easily the best episode of wrestling on TV this year. Every single segment worked. Keith Lee already feels like a bigger star in one night than he ever did in WWE. Tully Blanchard took a GTS at the end of an absolutely excellent tag match that featured – he almost didn't take it – that featured FTR paying tribute to the Smoking Guns of all teams. Jade Cargo continues to get better every week. Agreed. Serena Deeb is the best female heel in the business right now. There's a case for that. Andrade thinking Darby works for Sting pops me to no end. I'm totally with Zach on that. I love Andrade thinking Darby is like this 13-year-old boy that works for Sting and he wants to hire him to do his yard work or whatever. I don't know what's going on there. It there's a lot of ways to interpret that, some good, some bad, and I'm just every week I do. It pops me. And I hope Hangman, but with Chad, I mean, it's more conventional heel. With Andrade, it's just like we don't know why he has. And with Andrade, it's like, why does he want Darby to work for him? Like, what is this fascination with this boy, this kid, and Sting, he works for you. Like, what is there some cultural thing that he's referencing? Is he just infatuated with the idea of having this young, thin assistant work for him? I don't know. Maybe there's a Roddy type joke.
If I was going to read it meta, I would say this could be kind of a reverse role play where Latinos and Latinas especially have been hired as maids for rich white folk, and
right.
Maybe he's reversing it, and he's the rich Latino hiring the white person to be his kind of maid or servant.
I think that's a legit possibility, but nobody's narrowing it down at all. It's just funny. And I love he's confused because Darby's small, and to him, small means young. And and like, yeah, it's just, I don't know. I am getting a kick out of it. And then Zach says, I hope Hangman has a blood transfusion waiting for him because he hit a gusher. That was a wild finish to a brutal match. What a great show. So, yeah, I mean, we've talked quickly about a lot of the good aspects of the show while also, you know, extrapolating on things that I think make – because an exciting show isn't always the most productive or effective or efficient show. You know, any given week you can just throw blood and dream tag matches and killer promos out there and pack them all into 2 hours where you're just breathless at the end. But, you know, it isn't just about going to a buffet and shoving everything into your mouth and going, oh my God, this was just great. it's almost wrestling gluttony, what AEW sometimes produces. And so finding a happy medium between last week's show and this week's show, as someone kind of mentioned, might be good. And having a show that's really exciting to watch doesn't mean that it solves some of their problems. And Keith Lee coming across as a big star, which I agree he did, doesn't solve the issues. WWE had no problem making Keith Lee a big star. They had a problem with whether Keith Lee could, you know, be a top star in the ways that every other top star is relied upon to be a top star, which is, you know, being professional, easy to work with, and being able to have main event matches without blowing up or being at risk of, like you said, hitting the top rope as he's trying to do a move. That was a signature move when he was 80 pounds lighter, give or take. So, yes, I mean, you created a star in someone who now you've got to deal with and figure out, you know, and maybe they're fine with that. Maybe, like, we don't care about if he's going to pout about being asked to do a job. We pay him. He'll do what we say. We're not going to take offense to that. We're not control freaks like WWE. We don't have to baby everybody. And you know what? He's a big star. Fans react to him. We're just going to put wrestlers out there who bounce off of him and create all the moves. And if he's blowing up and needs rest periods, he can strike a pose and smirk and the fans will cheer and we'll make money with him. Great. They have fewer rules than WWE does about who gets the benefit of a massive push in front of millions of people on TV. And maybe they can make it work. Maybe the WWE is too strict or strident in their expectations of people conforming to certain things, but it's something to keep an eye on. Anyway, Bruce, there were a lot of thoughts there. Anything you want to react to from Zach?
I have heard, and I've seen on Twitter too, a lot of people calling this the best Dynamite ever. I wonder how much of that is recency bias or how much of that is just the aftertaste of Brandy's promo last week and people just trying to get that out of their system. It was good. It was a good Dynamite. But as you said, there were those things that stood out to us that we've discussed, like the tag match overbooking, like the end of the main event, that seemed a bit miscontrived, for lack of a better term. But, you know, Jade Cargill does keep improving. She's looking better and better each and every week. She's showing more confidence. That spot today where she lifted AQA in her arm and in a powerbomb position, but then flexed with the other arm while she was holding her, That is one of those star-making images that you hold on to for a highlight reel. So she's doing very well, and I'm very excited to see. Because to think of where she was with that first match with Shaq to where she is now, that is what gives me hope in terms of, say, Keith Lee getting in better shape. They've shown that even without having house shows, because they have access to certain wrestling schools, a lot of these wrestlers have improved, and they've improved rapidly. So I'm hoping that that remains the case, and because of that, that people like Keith Lee and others can stay in better ring shape. Now, there are still some of those issues where they skip two steps to get to a certain part in a story that they can come back and sort of rectify a little bit. But overall, this was a good Dynamite. I do think that in terms of overall sort of impact for me, I think the best Dynamite was probably the Broadway with Danielson and Paige, that Dynamite episode, just because to me, you and I think were one of the few who really said that Broadway was a real possibility and turned out to be that way. And you and I were one of the few actually who liked the match. So to me, that was probably the best Dynamite ever, but this is one of those Dynamites that you can definitely put in the conversation.
All right. Up next, Animesh says, Highway and Bruce, Jade Cargill racked up another win. I, for one, subscribe to the idea of the storyline taking cues from Rocky III with several more wins against lesser opponents to pad up the winning streak that eventually leads to either Cargill getting too overconfident or undermining an opponent. Where do you see the storyline going? Also, is it too soon to even be thinking of a face turn for Jade Cargill? I think someone brought that up earlier, Bruce. Do you think there's potential or opportunity there? The crowd certainly seems to be reacting to her athleticism and in smart Mark Sterling, and there's a natural unlikable heel for her to rally against. As said on Jericho's podcast, all it takes is for her to get back up after a big beatdown and do a few power moves. Thanks again for all the great content. If I'm to explore this more, Jade Cargill's promos are, at this point, there's a brand to her promos, and she gets right to the point. It's very self-centered, very cocky, and I would need to see how that translates as a babyface, and sometimes all it takes is who is she against, and it's contextual. And so if the idea is, yeah, let her be a baby face where the heels bump like crazy for, and you put MJF-type heels against MJF-level heels against her, and fans can't wait to see them do for Jade Cargill to smash him with power moves, I mean, I think that can work. I think they can do it. But I don't know if you want to do it this quickly. I think there's more of a story to tell with her as a heel, but you also have to look at the reality of what the babyface depth chart is. And if they can tell that story well, I thought her match tonight, you know, she's been getting better, but the match broke, you know, started turning into a cluster mess at the end. I mean, there were some, you know, it seems like the second shooting star press spot was supposed to happen in a different way. And then they went to the other corner. Jade is sort of standing in the middle of the ring going, what do I do? Okay, I'm going to charge at you. You could tell they were trying to think on their feet and make up for something that went wrong. I would have put those two against each other on off like an actual dark match, not the televised dark match, the untelevised. I would have had them practice that match for 4 weeks in a row off camera. Sure, fans will see it. They'll report on it. Who cares? I would have them work a match in front of a crowd before you put it on TV. And in the meantime, tell the story that tell a more credible story of why AQA is getting a title shot. So she can win some squashes on dark, make a case, show it for a few weeks on TV. There's this new rising star. She's talking crap. She wants to take Jade Cargill down. I just think you can get a lot more out of that match than they did. And I think they should have practiced it because Jade could use practice against an opponent she's never worked against. And on live TV, that's asking a lot of her. So there's some of my critiques. Your thoughts?
I mean, obviously, I think Jade Cargill has babyface potential, but I also agree. It's definitely not right now. I think ideally, you would have Cargill be champion probably into the summer. She can, you know, have the overconfidence happen, and she could lose to whoever they might put up there, whether it's, Thunder Rosa if she's not at the AEW the women's champion level, or, you know, a Riho or someone that like an Anna Jay or Red Velvet. But to me, the babyface turn comes in her comeback from that. Maybe she sees that, that introspection that she doesn't need Mark Sterling because, well, I mean, she's just that good. And because of Sterling's presence, she got a little, you know, overconfident, et cetera. And then she could start making the comeback. And so here's it's a tricky situation. Here are two people that I'm going to bring up that it can go either way. If it's done well, because you're talking about how her promos is kind of that very, you know, the confident to bordering on arrogance, all that kind of stuff. For certain people, that can be seen as, you know, there are certain athletes in pro sports where we like their cockiness and their arrogance. And there are others where we look at the cockiness and the arrogance and we want to punch them in the face. So if done well, she can become a Bianca Belair. If done not so well, she can become a Charlotte Flair. I picked those two out because their promos are in a similar vein of I'm better than you, I'm the best, etc. And I do think that if they give it the time and the patience and the focus, that maybe in a year or so, they can have that good version of Jade Cargill as a face. But if they do it any sooner, I think it'll turn into her not necessarily knowing what to do at that point yet as a babyface and kind of floundering as Charlotte Flair did as a babyface. So those are my thoughts. While she does have that potential, right now is definitely not the time to do it because she has so much going for her right now and into the future.
Okay. Is there anything else, Bruce, you want to bring up for this show that we haven't yet? Because I mean, somebody touched on Jericho coming across as more of a heel. I actually want to throw that to you.
I said that, actually.
Oh, you did? Okay, well, great. elaborate on that more, because I don't know if that – I don't know what they're going for. And, you know, mm-hmm. WWE's had this thing going on lately where it's like, you know, Seth and Roman. And, I mean, there's so many instances now of, like, who are we supposed to like here?
Right.
And it's just not clear. Like, Santana and Ortiz, if they're supposed to be heels, are way more convincing in their argument, way more way more likable. And then you got, you know, Jake Hager, who's not likable. You know, he doesn't have really a personality that they've developed, but he's just standing there, you know, arms crossed, you know, looking mean as Jericho's trying to make this case. But I think fans are listening, and I don't know what the intent was, but the crowd was booing Jericho tentatively and cheering Santana and Ortiz at the points they were making. And frankly, Eddie Kingston, I think, is more popular than Chris Jericho right now with fans. Not in terms of singing a song, but I think people are going to side if Kingston and Jericho were at odds. They're going to go, I'm probably on Team Eddie on this one. And Santana and Ortiz articulated their argument well.
Yeah, and having Jake Hager as the one on your side is definitely not going to put anyone on your side in terms of the fans, because why would we cheer Jake Hager? That's just an aside. But the one line here that really did it for me, I guess it's more than one line, but Jericho said, you embarrassed me by not tagging me in. Then you deprived all the fans a chance of seeing me wrestle, right? So for me, Jericho, even though he was supposedly the face in this interaction, came off as an arrogant arrogant narcissist that only see Santana and Ortiz as avenues to display his talents again. And for when you're looking at Santana and Ortiz and how they delivered their lines, you can't teach that kind of conviction. That kind of conviction that they delivered in their lines, it just feels so authentic that you kind of do believe there is real tension between them, even though it's a worked angle. And because, going back to what I said about Santana earlier, even Ortiz was his few lines, he was very to the point, passionate without being Dolph Ziggler. And I just feel like Sammy Guevara is a whole different kind of issue by himself. But between Santana Ortiz and then Jericho and Hager, I don't see how you can go into that and look at Proud and Powerful as anything but the faces unless you have an axe to grind against them for whatever reason it might be, and you like Jericho and Hager for whatever reason it might be, and I'm leaving that very ambiguous.
Anything else you want to bring up, Bruce, from the show?
One thing I wanted to bring up is the Blade looks like someone in the movie Hostel when he comes out in his gear, and it just makes me laugh, and I don't take him seriously. Even though – so – he got some offense in on Wardlow, and at least they tried by saying he had won something like six of his last eight matches. But I think – and so it serves well that Wardlow beat him, but I don't know if the offense being put in was necessarily required. But that's just a nitpick. I think overall, to me, the MVPs of this episode, promo-wise, were Santana and then Ortiz, and then I think in-ring, it's definitely FTR. I think what they did, even in a losing effort tonight, cannot go unnoticed or without compliment, because they are just, when it comes to just technical tag team wrestling and storytelling, especially when you look at how, just the basics of how old school tag team wrestling is told and how they perform, there might not be a better tag team out there in terms of that kind of style. And I just want to commend them again for their work, their selflessness, and how they perform and how they put people over, and just also in their look of the 70s with their hair and the color on their tights. So good for FTR.
FTR are fantastic. I'm in there. Yeah. And I would have slowed the match down, you know, 10-20%, milked some spots a little bit more, taken, you know, 16 good ideas and whittled them down to 11 or 9 in the match with the time that they had. But I mean, they're just so good. And mm-hmm. you know, seeing Moxley come out, by the way, CM Punk put out on Twitter, Samoa Joe, are you in the country?
Yeah.
Which was great. But you know, Moxley's a great partner. I kind of like, so much happens on AEW where I want them to reflect on it afterwards.
Sure.
And I would have loved to have a post-match celebration with Punk and Moxley afterwards, or Punk celebrating and Moxley going, you know, hope I didn't let you down. Now you got that MJF. Go get him. You know, just something to kind of underline and accentuate what happened and let fans kind of, you know, have a moment to celebrate a little bit the victory and what it means. I liked MJF backstage, you know, throwing a fit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a matter of, is AEW getting the most out of everything that they do, or are they, you know, and I think this show was booked as a reaction to the viewership going down last week. I mean, I think Tony just kind of overcompensated or went to, okay, I need to fit more in and do more media interviews and tweet more mystery things that are going to happen and surprises. We had a mystery partner. We had a Forbidden Door. We had two people debuting. We had a Jade Cargill title match that they didn't mention until it was happening with no buildup for the challenger. I was told by someone in AEW, while the show was on the air, by the way, that they did have a video package on Archer and Hangman, and they cut it because they the show ran long. They were running out of time. Well, I mean, so that just underlines my point here.
Yeah,
cut some stuff out. I don't want a 3-hour Dynamite, but I don't want to watch a 2-hour Dynamite that should have been 3 hours either. And that's what this felt like.
Yeah, no, just cut a few things back. We don't want this to turn into the old ROH shows where they were always running late and had to cut the main events. So, yeah, just cut a little bit. It goes back to what I think Bryant was saying earlier, that there's just too much packed into these 2 hours lately. And the last thing I'll say is good for AEW, because they're striking while WWE, at least Raw, is preempted by the Olympics. So viewership, ratings, this week, next week, they'll definitely, they'll probably outdo Raw in terms of total viewers and in terms of the rating. I think you put that they just barely hit a million viewers on Monday on Sci-Fi. So for AEW, this will be a good time to see, and then a good way to kind of recalibrate after the Olympics are done to see how much of that they've kept in terms of the momentum.
Absolutely. Bruce, tell people how they can follow you on Twitter, if you want people to.
Sure. So you can follow me on @B_Lee253. Lately, myself, Rich Fan, and some others, we've been in this big group kind of thread talking about the new game Shifu on PlayStation. Just a really good kung fu, really hard game. So we're doing a lot of that, but you can find me there. And then on Tuesday nights, I do the NXT 2.0 Alt Perspective Report. So you can find mine right next to Kelly Wells' report every Tuesday night.
Fantastic. You can follow our brand @PWTorch, and you can follow me @TheWadeKeller. On Twitter. Hope you're checking out our website, pwtorch.com, for the aforementioned Bruce Hazelwood reports on NXT on USA, alongside Kelly Wells' main reports on the TV show every Tuesday night. So a couple perspectives every week for NXT. And keep following my live TV coverage on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights, covering Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. That also gives you the direct link to our direct live stream that starts roughly 5 minutes or so after the shows go off the air. I want to underline, this was a blast of a Dynamite to watch in a two-hour adrenaline rush, and there were some great performances. The critiques during this are aimed at pointing out how it might have been better, or they might have gotten more out of what they did. Mm-hmm. We talked about, you know, the New Japan aspect and the Bullet Club aspect with Jay White and in the Young Bucks, and my focus on a lot of the show has been, could they have gotten more out of what they did? Did they try to put too much into the show? And are they leaving some fans behind or bewildered or confused or curious but not sure what any of it meant? And we've talked about this from the beginning of our coverage of Dynamite. Just don't get too lost in the Twitterverse. Twitter is not the world, and it's certainly not who you are trying the audience. You're not going to grow by convincing more people following you on Twitter to watch your show. You're going to grow by putting a show out there that people who are watching, who have friends who tell them you got to watch this show, or who sample it now and then, not to feel lost or overwhelmed, and to know who the stars are and to know emotionally how they're supposed to feel. And I just think it was an exciting show for people who like Dynamite. I think there's room to get better in other areas so that they are more likely to grow and bring new fans in, not just super serve people who love the term Forbidden Door and would wear it on a t-shirt 5 days a week if they could.
Agreed.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to our callers and emailers. And until next time, Wade Keller thanking you again and signing off.